Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Of the night, my eyes are closed about this world. I could see her face, her beautiful hair. I could recognize.
I want to start off by talking to you about New York. Because I've never been to New York, but I've had a lot of real, like, New York characters on the show. Jesse Malin, Tommy Victor, like a lot of dudes from that city that have been integral to the city's music landscape and scene.
Right.
And I love hearing all about it, because for me, that whole Max's Kansas City CBGB scene spawned so much great art, even from the hip-hop side of things as well, and disco. It was like a period of time where I guess the three main musical genres that dominated the 20th century and beyond, punk, disco, hip-hop, all were born in one place in like a couple of year window. So the landscape of that place and that time fascinates me.
Mm-hmm.
So you were born in New York, right? In what year? 71?
71. 71. Yep.
So you obviously were slightly too young to get that initial wave, but you would have been right there as a teenager for like the New York hardcore wave, right?
Well, the second round of it, I think. Like the tail end of Agnostic Front, Cro-Mags, Leeway, Sheer Terror. Carnivore had already broken up and reunited. So early 90s, like LOA started summer 89. And we were actually more involved in the Brooklyn scene rather than the CBGB scene. So Lemoore's was our home.
Right.
And we would take the bus to Lemoore's. You know, we were all going to high school together. And then college in the city. Joey and I went to art school. And we would play with the band on the weekends and jam, you know, after school during the week. Or cut out of school and stay in my basement and write songs.
Yeah.
but we would be at Lemoore's every week. Didn't matter really which bands were coming through. That was the place to hang out. And it was a scene as far as that's where your friends were going to be. And it was a fun time.
Who did you see? Like,
we saw Slayer there.
Fuck.
You know, Sold Out. Faith No More. Quicksand. White Zombie. Biohazard was rising in the scene at that time. As an unsigned band, and then when they got signed, it was like your friends got made in the mob, you know. They're a national act now, holy shit, you know. And that was inspiring to us to see, because we looked up to those guys. They were a couple years older than us. We've got Billy here tonight at the Whiskey,
right,
playing with Power Flow. So it's like the family's back together again. You know, Joey and I would draw T-shirts for those guys. Joey roadie for Billy. I actually grew up across the street from Evan as a child. Before music was even in our lives, we literally lived right across the street from each other in Canarsie. And
was he always a larger-than-life character?
Yeah, he was. There was one time it was snowing, and he's shoveling snow, wearing these fuzzy, knee-high mammoth boots.
Like the rave boots. Yeah.
And ripped jeans, no shirt, and streaked Bon Jovi type of hair. Shoveling snow outside, and his mother screaming at him, "Evan, get your ass in here. What are you doing? You're crazy." And I'm like looking at him from across the street through the window. And I said, "Mom, what's up with him? What's up with Evan? Why is he shoveling snow with no shirt on?" She's just shaking her head. But we ended up moving away in my early teens. And then I had some kind of accident where I needed stitches, and I was in the hospital, and Evan was delivering pizza to, used to work at Lenny and John's, the local pizza hangout, and he was delivering pizzas to emergency room, and recognized my father. He didn't recognize me. I had long hair down on my ass by then, and he recognized my dad, and he came over, and he's like, "Alan?" I was like, "Yeah," and I was probably about 16 at that point, and he gave me a pass to come see Biohazard at Lemoore's, and that was my first experience seeing a heavy metal concert in the flesh.
That was it?
Yeah. Biohazard at Lemoore's. I think they played with White Zombie.
Because they were a New York band as well. I forget that sometimes. Like, sure. They were synonymous with that kind of 90s alternative.
Yeah, they came up in that
there,
whole
scene, they?
Yeah. So,
who's that dude, the gay promoter? There was a documentary made about him recently, the famous...
Michael Lago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who the fuck's that guy? Is the documentary,
yeah, we're very
right?
close with Michael.
What an amazing character he was.
Sweet guy. Yep.
The irony of chatting to you about New York on Sunset Boulevard is so wonderful.
We've been coming here
well.
A long time. I remember driving out here in a van that was breaking down. We went from Brooklyn, New York, straight out, 3 days straight, no stopping, only for gas and some food, arriving to play L.A. for the first time. Never, I don't think any of us had come out west before.
Where was that first show at? You remember?
I don't think it was the Whiskey, although we played the Whiskey that on that tour. I'm really not sure. I don't want to lie. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but we played Whiskey on that tour. I think on the Jenna Tortures tour. That was an odd pairing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what I like about the 90s in particular, maybe more so than ever before or since, is every band was so unique and distinct and different, even within scenes.
Oh, yeah. And, like, you know, especially the bands that would come through Lemoore's, because that was the spot. And even bands like XL from the West Coast and Suicidal that would come through, and you get these different flavors of punk and hardcore that it would influence the East Coast bands. And it was always cool to see that and discover bands without having to even search for them. They came right to our spot.
Express delivery style.
Yeah.
On your doorstep.
Yeah, and then you'd go to the record store and find their CD. Not their CD, their cassette back then. Or the vinyl. And even Misfits and all that stuff, you know. It's like there was no internet, so it's like if you were into music, you would find out by trading tapes.
Yep.
Or going to see live shows.
Original piracy.
That's right. Yeah.
Small scale piracy.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about art school. So you went there to study cartoon drawing, did you, or was it like a broad degree that encompassed all cross sections of art, and then you just ended up specializing in that area because that was what was your
niche interest. I was always drawing, and I grew up as a very quiet, shy kid, and through drawing, I made a lot of friends because I would always draw what was ever on my mind, which was usually gory monsters or people getting their limbs torn off or whatever. I was into horror, and I would sit at the lunchroom table in school and just doodle, and kids would look over my shoulder and go, "Oh, look what he did today," you know, and I wouldn't have to say a word. And I made a lot of friends like that. Over time, I got more outgoing and it was easier, but that definitely helped break the ice in a social setting for me. So I always did well in the art classes, much better than math or science or anything like that. And I ended up getting into a specialized art, high school of art and design. You had to take a test. You had to do a drawing test, a written test. I got in. It was in the city, so it was a big trip for me, taking the subway and stuff for the first time as a kid. I went there, and then I would take an express bus back to Brooklyn, and it was like an hour and a half each way. And I would get home, I would leave in the dark and come home in the dark every day, and I really was not liking it. And I was really into metal. I was into, like, at that time, Possessed and Slayer and Venom and stuff like that. So I had long hair, the MC, and I'm standing at the bus stop every day, and here's this kid next to me with kind of like curly hair, a curly devil lock, an MC, always with Misfit stuff on, and we never said a word to each other. We were too cool to talk to each other, and we were at the same bus stop every day for 6 months.
I love it.
And that was Joey Zampella, and we didn't know each other, but we both were in that school. And we both transferred at the same time to the Brooklyn High School because right. We didn't like the high school. We didn't like the commute, and there was also a lot of racial violence in that school. So we both transferred, and then we recognized each other in the same art class in the Brooklyn school.
And finally plucked up the courage to say hello and talk.
Yeah. I love and it. One of the first experience we had was I had already reconnected with Evan. I was going to the Biohazard rehearsals when they were unsigned, and I had the Biohazard demo on cassette on my Walkman. And I said, "You want to hear something really cool?" And I let him hear it, and he loved it instantly. And I brought him to the studio to meet Biohazard, and we've been friends ever since. And, you know, that really got us going as wanting to do music. You know, I had, at that time, I was playing in a local band, and Joey and Keith back then were playing in their own band right across the street from each other on the same block. And then they lost a member, and I decided to join them, and then we changed the name. I had the idea to name it Life of Agony, and it really started right back then, 1989.
It happened pretty fast as well, it's safe to say, right? I mean, the response to that first album was insane, and that was a massive album for Roadrunner, for that genre. It was a huge, like, debut splash that you guys made, wasn't it, with that album?
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, so from, I would say, our first show was 1990, February 11th. Between 1990 and 1992, when we got signed to Roadrunner, we felt this momentum, you know, from this little hardcore band to finding our sound, to working with Josh Silver from Typo Negative, who produced our early demos, and eventually River Runs Red, the album. We had the same management as Typo Negative, so it was very incestuous.
Yeah.
And and it was definitely a big, you could feel the swell of the popularity of the band growing. We would go up and down the East Coast all the time, building a following, until finally that record came out, and We made a big impact. And then we went to Europe for the first time on a sold-out tour with Propane. And the reaction there for the band was just mind-blowing.
What's your memory, before we talk more about the album, what is your memory of Typo Negative, and especially of Pete, as a rock star, really, like a true larger-than-life, unique figure in musical history? He was a one-of-a-kind dude,
tell you,
right?
He's one of the funniest motherfuckers I ever met. Very, such a true, dark, Brooklyn, sarcastic type of humor. Very warm. And
exceptionally talented, right?
Oh, my God. I mean, I say it all the time, that this band would not exist without Carnivore. That was one of our biggest influences, and Pete's genius to just kind of open those doorways of imagination of what you could do with heavy music. you know, I have a lot of really awesome memories of him just not on the stage.
Yeah, how bad.
And hanging out in Josh's house. I was, you know, very close with Josh all through making the demos and the album. And we would hang out at his house. He had a studio in his house. So we would hang out and talk all the time. And Pete lived on that block. So Pete would just pop in from time to time. Sometimes, one time in particular, me and Josh are hanging out in Josh's room, and I hear all this banging and clanking outside. I'm like, what the hell is that? And Pete comes in, and he's wearing these like knee-high tube socks and like these Daisy Duke cut-off jeans and a tank top and a headband. And he asks Josh for a wrench or something like that. And he goes and gets it to him. And I look in the backyard, and Pete's building a 12-foot-tall metal cross that they ended up using in one of their videos. And it was like this Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. And it was just it was classic Pete, you know. It was like, oh, my God. And then, you know, we were actually in a few of the type of videos in disguises. The whole band was in the Black Number One video, dressed as droogs, you know, with all the long underwear and the dick noses.
Yeah, yeah.
That's us in the background, if you look closely. And then there was another Christian Woman video where we're like wearing like monk robes and gas masks, and we're dancing around some girl on a pentagram or some shit like that on the... It was like after hours at Lemoore's, and they like decorated everything with candles and stuff. It was wild. Lemoore's was like the hangout, you know?
Yeah.
So even like...
You'd go there even if there wasn't a gig, like it would be the spot where you just congregate and...
Yeah, because it was like we played cards there, we played poker there. Our manager at the time, Ken Creedy, was the guy that booked the shows there. So he had an office there. So we would go there after hours all the time and play cards and hang out and go to the office to talk to Ken and stuff. And then one time they hired Joey and I to paint murals in the place.
Nice.
And so we bought all this paint and we got ladders and we painted the whole club in these wild psychedelic faces and neon colors and stuff and black light. And it was wild. I got some pictures somewhere. And we were convinced the place was haunted because we only had 3 nights to paint it because they were opening up a new club on one end of it. And so we had to start at like 11 o'clock at night and paint all night until the people would come. And so we would separate. I was painting the lobby and Joe was in the back room. And then, he thought someone was calling his name. And he thought it was me. And he turned around and no one was there. And he starts running out to the front of the club. He's like, did you just call my name? Like, I was like, I've been on this ladder for like the last hour. And he was like, we got to get out of here. This place is haunted.
Wrap this job quick.
Yeah.
That's so good. That album, the first album, Memories of Making It for You, what springs to mind? And was it predominantly, would you say, from your mind? Were you the lead songwriter on that album?
Well, I wrote all the lyrics.
Right.
But it was definitely a group effort. And just the sound of it, like all the suggestions that Josh had made, tuning down, you know, we recorded all the demos in standard E tuning, and he suggested that we should tune down to D, which we did. And we were like, oh, yeah, this sounds heavier. And then he encouraged us to slow down the tempos to make it even more heavy. He encouraged us to, you know, just take another look at the song structures, and he had a vision for that record. He was able to see something that we couldn't see. And like, I was always a big Pink Floyd fan, and so was Mina, and so I always had the vision of wanting to do a concept record. And I think that's where all the interludes
yeah,
came through. But Josh was the one who put those soundscapes together. He knew how to use audio clips and layer them in a way to make them sound like real scenes. And so he was really gifted in that way. And so he was able to bring these ideas to life. And so even though, you know, maybe the idea spawned from me, he actually executed them from production standpoint in a creative way. And so in that way, it's very much a collaboration. And, you know, it couldn't have happened without everyone that was involved. And, it, you know, that record was so strong for Mina's voice and all the guidance that Josh gave her back then, and working with Joey on guitar sounds and really getting the right performances out of everybody, suggesting that Sal join us on the recording. And then later, you know, he joined the band, but at the time he was still in Type O.
It's such a unique album from that time period. Like, it stands up. It's 25 years, isn't it, this year?
Yep.
Which is insane.
Yeah, yeah.
I spoke to Mina, obviously, she's been on the show, and she talked a bit about her childhood, her upbringing. If you wrote the lyrics, and a lot of the themes in that album are quite dark and difficult and painful, did you have a tumultuous upbringing as well? Were you writing about a lot of stuff that was close to home for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was definitely a frustrated, depressed, angry person. And I got a lot of that out through the music. And I think that also, you know, songs like This Time, which were directly about Joey's upbringing and his relationship with his family, just being so close with one another, I was able to take his feelings and put them into lyrics. And I think that's why that record did connect with so many people, because these are such common problems and common themes that everyone goes through at that age.
Yeah.
In that time. And that's why it's had the longevity, because it was written in a way that even if you put it on now, you could relate to the message. And that's something that we tried to tap into again in the later records, when we realized that these albums were helping people.
Yeah.
In a cathartic way. And every record that we've done after that captured that bit of time of who we were at that time. And we never tried to write River Runs Red Part 2.
Well, Ugly was kind of quite distinctly different, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was almost a reaction to River Runs Red.
Yeah.
It was a reaction to touring for 2 years. It was a reaction to living with one another. It was just a whole different experience. And in a way, the band at that time was more isolated with each individual. We weren't very very much on the same page.
You weren't?
No.
Is that because of what was going on with the success of the group was dividing you, and you were dealing with the fame, if you want to call it that, differently? Or
I don't know if it was fame, but it was always like you had a lot of pressure on you at that point to top the last one.
Uh-huh. That's the problem with such a critically acclaimed and commercially successful debut, I guess, isn't it? Is how do we follow this? There's pressure on you from yourselves as much as from outside.
Well, you know what it is? It's like from 1990 to 1992 when we recorded it, you had this dream that you were after that probably was never going to happen, but we were handed a record deal. We were handed tours to play with some of our heroes, you know.
Like who? Who did you get to go out with that was like a dream come true?
Well, we played with Ozzy, you know, we played with Danzig, we played all over the world in front of massive crowds. I mean, when we first started, we were playing literally on two ping pong tables with a string light bulb in a place that was called Twin Lights, and there wasn't even one light in the whole place. I mean, we were playing these little hardcore shows in front of our friends. And
other bands. Yeah.
Yeah, and their girlfriends. Yeah, yeah. You know, and they were serving pizza upstairs, or, you know, the one place that comes to mind is we played a pancake house in Pennsylvania. We played the basement of the pancake house. And Mina, the power kept going out. And Mina kept saying, come on, what's up? What's going on with this place? And we finally got the power back on. She was annoyed, and she was like, I want to see you motherfuckers tear this roof down. And they literally did. They started punching the ceiling, the sheetrock ceiling, and the whole ceiling fell down in this pancake house. And the owners came down. This elderly couple comes down, and they're like, what did you do to our place? Until this day, we have people asking us to sign pieces of the ceiling.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that's where we come from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we don't forget that. And everything that we get to do, play with our heroes, we played with David Bowie, you know, we played with Slipknot, we played with Black Sabbath, Metallica. We're still in awe of the experience, even 25 years later, because we know that we played the Pancake House. And it's hard to, you know, accept the evolution even all these years later, in a way. You know, it's still like you gotta pinch yourself, like, wow, pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing. And there's obviously been like breaks and then reunions, which we'll talk about. I'm a good friend, a dear friend of mine is Whitfield Crane, and he sends his love.
I love Whit, yeah.
And
we talk all the time.
Obviously, when Mina left the band in, was it 97? Was the original, like, parting of ways?
Soul Searching Sun came out that year, and that's when she left.
Was it evident while you were making the album that things weren't great, and it was maybe, like, playing out in that way? Or
no. In fact, making that record was a lot of fun.
Right.
And I felt like we were actually in a more positive place. Even the artwork on the record was more vibrant and colorful and, you know, hopeful in a way. Even though there's some really dark lyrics on that record, the vibe of it and the production of the record was very uplifting, I think. Songs like Tangerine.
Yeah, and even the album title as well is The River Runs Red, Uglier. Definitely a lot darker and more.
So I think we were in a better place, but I think she was battling her own demons with her sexuality back then and her own identity. And I feel like, and I believe that she said this to me along the way, is that she didn't want to be a success as a man. And kind of, you know, just had to leave before it happened, because we all felt like it was going in that direction. And so
it wasn't like the creative well was drying. It wasn't like the band wasn't functioning and achieving and progressing.
No, in fact, we had more opportunities at that with that record than ever before, because songs like Weeds were doing so well at radio, and it was opening a lot of doors for us, even in different continents. Like, it was doing really well in Australia, a place we had never been before, and we had plans to do Australia, New Zealand, Japan on that album that we were forced to cancel because she left the group. And I'll never forget, we're on the cover of the Aquarian local New Jersey paper, music paper. It's like an entertainment music paper. And in the back, we had a want ad for a new singer. We're on the cover, and we had a want ad for a new singer in the back.
That's crazy.
The crazy time it was. And like, when she quit, we were locked in to do a video for the song Desire. And everything was all set. And Roadrunner was like, we need you to do the video anyway. And we just had a bunch of characters mouth the words. And, you know, Mina wasn't in the video. But we didn't want to lose momentum because we had worked so hard on the album.
Of course.
And I think it was Scott Ian and the Anthrax guys that said we should try out Wit. Because we had tried out a bunch of singers.
So that was Scott's suggestion.
Yeah.
Right. Because for me, I know Wit so well. And his voice on paper for me is like the perfect fit for your band. Like, I think there's very few people that can hit those notes. And
that was a problem. People couldn't hit those notes.
Yeah.
They couldn't pull off the River Runs Red stuff. And
he's so underrated as a vocalist, isn't he? Because he's known as this singer in this kind of fun time, you know, Californian.
Yeah, and I wasn't that familiar with Ugly Kid Joe, and I wasn't that familiar with how different they were in perception of a band.
Mm.
I just, you know, we wanted a singer that was a confident frontman, and Wit walked in with this confidence and with the pipes.
Yeah.
And we were like, yeah, he has experience in front of large crowds. He was playing arenas with Bon Jovi at one point. So we were like, let's see if it could work. We were offered the Megadeth tour, and we didn't want to turn it down. And so I wrote out all the lyrics on this giant oak tag papers for him. And so the stage looked like, if you were in the balcony, it just looked like a bunch of cue cards on the floor. He pulled it off. I give him a lot of credit. He learned a lot of material in a very short amount of time. We rocked some really big crowds that year. We did the Ozfest 98, which were big crowds for us in America. We were playing with System of a Down and Incubus.
Around the time they were blowing up as well.
Yeah, right? On their first album.
Yeah.
Yep. And Limp Bizkit was also, I think that was probably the year of the Nookie.
Yep.
And Fred Durst would come on stage and jam with us with Wit. And so we were like excited that, hey, maybe we have a shot of continuing what we love to do, even though Mina had left.
Can we, before we continue, was it a painful breakup when Mina left?
It's funny. We had our last show together was Irving Plaza, New York City. And she called me the next morning and she said, Al, I just can't do this anymore. I'm going to have to quit. I said, that's cool. And that's...
You saw it coming.
We had conversations and the last thing she said was, yeah, I'm just in too much pain to continue. And I accepted that. And that was it. And then I was hurt because I didn't understand why she was so in this turmoil, or why, you know, the big thing back then was, you know, she wanted to do other types of music.
Yeah.
But we were like, you can do both, you know, we're not saying it's one or the other, do both, do your solo stuff and do LOA. But, you know, there always seemed that missing ingredient of, what else aren't you telling us that, you know, we gave her all the options, but, you know, until she came out.
Figured it out for herself. Yeah.
What she needed to be happy. Yeah. So. It was that missing ingredient, that unspoken truth that we didn't quite understand, like, until it was revealed.
So that's quite a big gap for you guys, right? Was there a lot of unanswered questions and...
At that time?
Unanswered feelings, yeah.
Well, you know, the run with Wit was going so well on the road. Roadrunner wanted a new album. And so we started demoing... new material with Wit, and we got Josh Silver back as a producer who we hadn't used since the River Runs Red record. And it just sounded like Ugly Kid Joe, heavier Ugly Kid Joe,
yeah.
With his voice on it. And
was he writing the lyrics, or were you writing the lyrics?
I was writing the lyrics.
Right.
Yeah. And but he has a very signature sound to his voice.
Yeah.
And so it didn't sound like Life of Agony. It, and we weren't 100% about. We didn't want to, in our minds, we didn't want to put out a record without Mina.
And call it Life of Agony.
And call it Life of Agony. So we were considering changing the name. And that's where Joey and I split at that point. I went and did a band called The Monk Thieves. And Joey did Stereo Mud with Dan Richardson, who was on drums. And we just went our separate ways for a couple of years. And then we got back for the 2003 reunion with the River Runs Red lineup.
And that was a couple of shows. And then did you do... What was the album you did around that time?
Well, we toured for a couple of years.
Yeah.
With the lineup and doing really well. And then we signed to a major label for the first time.
Sony, was it?
Yeah, yeah. We signed to Sony for the Broken Valley record.
That's the one.
Which
right.
came out 2005, and that was a whole nightmare. But
is that because of what they did to you with the release of the album, or was it the recording as well? Was it kind of everything?
I think it was kind of a little bit of everything. It was the universe. It was, you know, I think we had a lot of fun making the record. We lived together. We ate together. We moved into a handmade house in Woodstock, New York.
So you did reconnect as people. And
yeah,
the experience
I think so.
Was
yeah,
positive.
I think we had a good time making that record. I did. And we worked with a great producer, Greg Fiddleman, who worked with Metallica and Slipknot. And he came and hung out every day in the Woodstock house, and we recorded those sessions.
Oh, that's where you did it?
Yeah. Well, we did pre-production there.
Wow.
And then we actually came out here to record in a lot of famous studios. And it was a fun time. We spent a lot of time together. It really felt like a band. We were sharing ideas. Mina and I would work on lyrics together for that record, rather than separate songs. So it was very collaborative and very cool. And then...
And what went wrong?
Well, we were kind of talked into doing some tours that we weren't sold on the matchup of the bands, and we didn't go over well with the bands we were playing with those crowds, and it really killed our spirit. And that was leading up to the release. And then once it was released, it was pulled off the shelf 3 months later because Sony had released 12 albums with illegal spyware on the records, including like Neil Diamond and Janet Jackson, I think. Big artists. They were trying to prevent people from pirating CDs. So once you put the CD in your computer, it would not let you illegally download music anymore, secretly. And they weren't allowed to put that on the CDs, and they lost this big class action lawsuit, and a judge ordered them to pull all the records off the shelf. They reissued the ones that were big sellers, and for a little rock band like Life of Agony.
So the likes of Neil Diamond and Janet Jackson could come back from that. Okay. Hold on, let's just wait for... Hollywood. But obviously, yeah, for you guys, especially like recently reformed.
Oh yeah.
And
it was,
I mean,
like,
what a magic opportunity for you guys to, you know, be presented with as well at that point. You must have thought like, fuck yeah, like the universe has kinda has come together for us. This is a real special.
And we did some great tours, great shows on that run. And play with some fantastic artists. But at the end of the day, it didn't reach the height that we wanted, that the goals were set for. And
did it set the band back as well also?
In what way?
In the sense that, because obviously you didn't continue for long after that, right?
Well, that was 2005. I get lost with the timing there, but I think the next split was 2011.
Okay, so there was another healthy run and chapter of the band's life.
But we weren't into writing new material.
Right.
Because we were like, what's the point? Because
you'd been burnt by the music industry. And
we were pretty jaded by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we wanted to, at that point, we wanted to tour on our own terms. We didn't want to listen to anybody. We wanted to play with who we wanted to play, where we wanted to play, for the amount of time we wanted to play. And when we were calling our shots and planning everything, we were happier. And we felt like, I guess, we were getting our control back, because when you sign to a major label, there's a lot of people you have to answer to as far as the type of material you're going to write. They check up on you to see if you have that hit single that they're looking for. And this isn't that type of band. I think we have a lot of songs that could be on the radio, but we don't write songs to be on the radio.
No.
So maybe the label were trying to mold us into something that we weren't.
Because they want their return.
Yeah.
It's an interesting dichotomy, isn't it? Because I think there's so many bands out there that are so radio-friendly and commercially appealing in sound. But then I think the minute you start trying to mess with that sound and what makes that band unique and special, you take the soul out of it. And then anyone who was with them for that journey up until that point is kind of like, what? And then all these new people, because they are so alternative to what commercial music is now.
I'll tell you, though, there's a lot of songs on that record that I love. And I'm proud of the record, despite that it got pulled off the shelf because of this spyware.
Well, it was obviously nothing to do with the strength of the material on the album, was it? It's just a fucking horrible,
it was more
unfortunate.
You know, the band has evolved into a very diverse animal. And while we have the River Runs Red material, we also have Soul Searching Sun material, and we have Broken Valley material, and even the new record. And somehow it all works together in the same set. Together. Even though they're so different. If you listen to the albums, it's almost like listening to different bands. You know, one could be hard rock or even commercial rock, and one has roots in hardcore and old school metal. But somehow when you put them all together in the same set, it works. And it makes it live experience interesting, because you have these hills and valleys and kind of take you on a journey through our catalog in a way. And that's what we've been experiencing now with Veronica on drums. You know, she learned like 25, 26 songs of songs we haven't been playing for decades, and they're new to us again and fun to play and even more diverse than we have been in the last few years, because now we're finding these like fan favorites that are deep tracks, songs like Unstable, which really hits home for people because it's about dealing with cancer in your family, and it's such a common thread these days. And we're putting songs like that back in the set and really going through all these different emotions, and reliving a lot of memories through the whole journey that we've been on.
I guess that's the trip, right? For you guys in the group, it's the soundtrack to your lives, and the soundtrack to the highs and the lows and the triumphs and the struggles and the experience, the full 360.
And celebrating the songs, because when you strip away all the business and the pressures and trying to make a living at doing something that you love and putting it all on the line to do something that you love and sacrificing, and the people that you leave home that are sacrificing with you, when you strip all those layers away, it's about the songs and poetry and emotions and trying to channel that into music. And when you play that, you know, on a night like tonight, it's really beautiful. You know, it's something really special about just like honoring the art of it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard. But thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So let's segue from one art form to another. When do you start really getting involved with the comic graphic novel side of things? Well, is that a continuous thing that you're practicing and, you know, exercising whilst the music's going on, or does that sort of kick fully into gear around that kind of 2010 second breakup of the band, when you figure, oh, maybe I want to try and explore a totally new avenue professionally now?
Like I was telling you, as a young child, I was always drawing in school, at the lunchroom table, doodling on my books. I in the neighborhood, as I was getting into heavy metal and rock music, I was the guy that you would come to paint your jacket, your denim jacket. I'd paint Iron Maiden Killers on the back of your jacket for $50 or whatever it was.
Right on. Oh, so you were hustling as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's great.
I was doing everybody's jackets. I was drawing on people's notebooks and all that stuff. And I would make my own comic books in my notebooks just for fun. I mean, that's how I kept busy, especially in the summer times. I would make my own comic books and I would photocopy them and talk the local comic shop into selling them for 25 cents or whatever it was on the rack. And they'd sell, you know, the whatever 30 copies I would make, they would sell by the end of the summer. People would buy them. And it was just fun. It was fun to be able to tell stories and make my own characters. And I grew up digging comics like The Punisher and stuff like that. And I eventually went to an art college. I got a scholarship to an art college. And I took a cartooning class that was taught by Walt Simonson, who drew The Mighty Thor. And also he worked on X Factor and a bunch of other stuff. And so he was my cartooning teacher, and I never did great in school. Halfway through my experience at college, the band started, and that was so much fun and so different and exciting, playing in front of people every weekend.
It's better than studying, right?
Better than studying. I was never into art history. And so I just got by in college. Yeah. My dad talked me into staying, because I wanted to quit and go on the road. The River Undread was just coming out in my senior year, and he convinced me to just hang it out for another 6 months, get my degree. He says, like, then you always have your degree. If the band doesn't work out, you could get a job doing this or that. So that was smart advice. I did that. I stuck it out. But I put the art on the side, and I jumped in the van with the guys, and we started playing and touring, and it was, you know, a crazy, high-energy experience. Visiting Europe, you know, in the early 90s, being in a different city every night.
You're getting inspired every day, right?
Yeah, it was hard, too, because the conditions, we were out for 2 months in the dead of winter with 26 people on a bus, you know. It was crazy times. But it molds you to who you are, and it shapes you, and all these experiences, you know, give you confidence that you can overcome other obstacles and things like that. So definitely life lessons. And you weren't going to get that in school.
No.
So I put the art on hold, although I was still drawing the covers for River Runs Red and the t-shirts and everything art related that a band needs, flyers, stickers, merchandise. And I was doing that throughout the whole history of the band. I think I drew every shirt that ever came out.
Still now as well?
Yeah.
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 Solid.
So I was always involved, and I was doing that for other bands too. I learned how to use a computer, and I would design websites for bands. I, you know, work with Shinedown and Three Doors Down and Puddle of Mud and a lot of bands like that. I was, you know, very early on, I was drawing Church for Biohazard and Type of Negative, and just kind of endless. I was just always that guy, the guy that knows how to draw and get it done, and people would come to me and I'd do it. And in college, I had this idea for a comic book that I never finished. And so by 2009, when the band started to slow down a bit, I was just so determined that I wanted to get this idea out of my head and make it real. And I went through a bunch of artists that work for Marvel to bring my story to life, because I wasn't that confident in my own drawings at that time. And I never got one sketch from these guys. I must have waited 4 to 6 months, and I never got anything. I got so frustrated that I said, I'm going to draw it myself. I don't care what it looks like. And I did it. And I was on Twitter for the first time, just following some comic book artists and writers that I liked. And through Twitter, I got a publishing deal.
Through Twitter?
Yeah.
How? I was tweeting some work out? And
no, I was just connecting with some people in the industry, and I noticed that this one cat liked heavy metal, and he made some posts about Motorhead, and I connected with him, and he was like, oh, I bought your record. And at the time, I just thought he was another writer of a book that I liked, and he turned out to be the editor-in-chief of one of the bigger indie comic book publishers that did 30 Days of Night and a lot of horror books, and eventually G.I. Joe, Transformers, Star Trek.
What's their name?
IDW.
IDW, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And now they're a powerhouse.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's the guy that gave me a shot, and he saw my first book was Wire Hangers. I shared the pitch with him, and he was like, "Yeah, we'll put that out." And I was like, "What? Really?" And yeah, they greenlit the book, and I was making a monthly comic book, and then it got collected into a graphic novel. And I figured while I still had their ear, I pitched them another story.
Go again. Yeah.
And I did this book called Crawl to Me. And after that, Killer G, which I incorporated Marky Ramone and Doyle from the Misfits and yeah. Frank Vincent.
And so with those, I mean, what a unique idea. How do you decide to pair together like a guy from Goodfellas and then Marky Ramone? Like, do you just think these are interesting cats that I've grown up with as pop culture icons that I'd like to see play off each other in this fictitious world?
The original idea was to make three Twilight Zone type of stories that intersected. And when I started drawing the characters, they just kept looking like these heroes of my childhood.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe I wonder if I'll just try and pitch them starring in my comic book. I don't think it had ever been done before to cast a comic book without, you know, coming off a TV show or something like that.
Yeah.
This was just a star in the comic book as a fictitious character.
As a new entity. Yeah.
And I was able to convince all of them. And they had never even seen any pages. I didn't draw it up, just the covers of them in action.
Just going on that New York connection, yeah?
Yeah. And I tried to, you know, find connections to each of them through people that I knew. And I got in the room and pitched them, and each one said yes. And all of a sudden, okay, here's this thing with all my heroes. And after that, we were able to adapt it into an animation using their own voices. And there's like a 6-minute proof of concept online. You can see at KillogyAnimated.com.
It's just spelled Kill, O-G-Y, right?
Yep. Like Trilogy, but yep. Killogy. KillogyAnimated.com, and we work with this Canadian 3D animation studio, which is fantastic. They took my artwork and were able to make 3D characters out of everyone and make these 3D environments, and the audio was very DIY. I would go to Frank Vincent's house. He'd invite me in his kitchen with my laptop, and he'd just do the voiceover right there in his kitchen. I went to Mark Ramone's studio right before a rehearsal, before a tour, to get a couple of lines from him.
I've never heard Doyle talk, but those other two have such distinct and incredible New York voices, yeah, as well. Like, yeah. Is Doyle like that as well? Is his voice like that too? Or is he... What's his vibe?
Doyle's a character in his own right.
I'd imagine him... I'm probably way off to just have like a super high... almost soft girl-like voice, no, just as such a juxtaposition to his insane physical physique.
He's very New York.
He is, right?
Very New York. he's a sweetheart, and it was so much fun and very exciting to work with them on a personal level, get to know them as friends, and even after we did the comics and the animation. Before Frank Vincent died, he would check up on me every couple weeks. Hey, how's it going, kid? You know, see if there's any updates or movement on the project. And
so he was invested in it, and he really cared and supported what you were doing.
Yeah, and we did some conventions together, and we got very friendly, you know. It was very cool, very sweet man. He was a musician as well when he was younger. He was a drummer. And so we would trade a lot of musician stories.
Nice.
And he had a band with Joe Pesci.
Really?
Yeah.
Not the rap project that Joe Pesci did.
Nope.
No.
They were like a Jersey 70s band, you know.
What, Little Steven kind of vibe?
Yeah, I mean, I think back then it was, you know, maybe it was a little earlier than that, maybe 50s or 60s. I have the clipping somewhere. I can send it to you, actually.
I'd love to see it.
And, you know, they would wear the suits and stuff.
Yeah.
And then it was a big kind of like 5-piece band. And Joe Pesci played guitar and sang. And Frank Vincent was behind the drums. And in between the songs, they would have this banter up and back. And they make people laugh. And then eventually they became like a Martin Lewis type of comedy act. And
what, like a double act?
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
And then that was how Scorsese became aware of them, was it?
Yeah, because they had this kind of rhythm.
Yep.
And they would play the clubs. And so when Pesci got Raging Bull, he says, I got someone to play Salvi. And they had this chemistry that was just undeniable. And that was the beginning of it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, the chemistry between Pesci and De Niro as well. It's so undeniable. And as you say, it's a very rhythmical, musical thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like there's a real flow to
that
it.
That timing.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about timing, me and Frank. And I actually interviewed him for an interview in the back of the Killogy graphic novel. And I have that whole recording. I really have to edit it for the public.
Yeah, you should, man.
It's so great. He's got great stories.
Would you ever consider doing something like this, like a podcast with illustrators and...
Yeah, I mean, you know what it is? I spend so much time drawing these days. It's either drawing or writing music or playing music that...
You're busy enough.
It's really hard to find any time to do anything else.
You got kids? You got a wife?
Yeah, I got a wife and a child. And
so with all of that together,
yeah,
you got your plate pretty full.
Yeah, I'm pretty full. And plus, you know, we're developing each of these comics into films and TV shows. With
are any of them close to being completed as features?
I've been at it years.
Yeah.
And I'm just starting to see one of them really get momentum. Because every time you think you're really close, you lose an element. You need so many things to align to make it happen.
Yeah.
Besides the obvious of the money, a script, the right producers, a distributor, all these things, not even including talent, the actors. You need all that to align and everyone to be on the same page, to have the same vision moving forward, to work within a schedule to actually execute it.
Yep.
I've learned that just because you have 3 out of the 5 pieces, that doesn't mean it's happening.
It's not the same as DIY punk rock, is
no,
it? Getting it done.
No, not at all. I wish it was. But Crawl to Me has come a really long way. We hooked up with these great writers that wrote a few features, and the original script was a very close adaptation of the comic, and along the way we've had several directors attached to it, several production companies attached to it. The rights have changed several times, but now we really have a great group of people, and the script went through a rewrite, and I think that's really headed in a really good direction. We're really hoping to film this winter.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the moment is nigh.
I hope so. I always say that it's not real until I'm in the seat eating popcorn.
Yep.
Watching it on the screen. That's when it's real.
Well, fingers crossed, dude. So if people want to find out beyond the band stuff, what's going on with you and keep up to date, have you got obviously a website? And
yeah, it's just my name.com,
AlanRobert.com.
Yep. And I have everything on there, the books, the films, the music.
Right on. And I guess just bringing it full circle with Life of Agony and the reconnection of you guys. And I mean, this new album is really powerful, really beautiful, really inspiring, really just like fresh, new. I mean, did it feel like with Mina coming back into the band transitioned that you were all reignited as creative people as well as friends? Like, did it feel like a brand new, fresh slate?
I don't know. For me, it was a bit different. I think that in 2014, when we came back out on the stage with Mina for the first time as Mina, that was the moment that we didn't give a shit what anyone thought. I was so proud of her. What a brave thing to do in such a masculine genre.
Genre, yeah.
And we were just like, fuck you if you don't like it. And that was the attitude that we took everywhere we went after that. Making new music, in a way, was just, you had to. It was 12 years after Broken Valley. It was like, we had to, you know? So it wasn't this epiphany.
Does it not feel like you're almost working with someone new, though?
Not at all.
No?
No.
It doesn't.
This is my old friend from childhood. If anything, it's just cool to see her happy.
Right. So are you then working with new ingredients at play in that sense? Like there's a reinforced sense of contentment and her being at peace. Does that feed into the writing in any way?
I think there's no doubt, because I know that nothing's holding her back now. So, and I feel that in the live situation too, that she really came out of her shell, because in the early 90s, she was very shy on stage and almost hid behind the microphone in a lot of ways when she was battling her own issues in her own mind.
And surrounded by all these other guy singers that are like,
and that's kind of like where we were going with the Ugly record, more introverted. And now she's right in everyone's face.
Yep.
With the new stuff and the old stuff. And it's a different live show. It's kind of like back to when we were kids, before she got lost along the way. And she may have always been battling that even as a young man, but it didn't show as much.
Because you have the exuberance of youth propelling you forward, don't you?
Yeah, and maybe, you know, you had this dark secret that no one knows about, and you carried off this persona to fit in with the scene or whatever. Mm-hmm. But once we were now out of that, you know, weekend warrior type of thing.
And the shackles and almost. Yeah, yeah.
And then it was like a profession, a career now, and this machine and this cycle of write, record, tour every year or whatever it was. Now it's like she just wants to play the songs and celebrate music and celebrate life, and it's kind of put all that darkness behind her. And that's, she really connects with the audience now in a way that she never did back then. And that's awesome to see. It's inspiring to me.
Kicking ass, taking names.
Yeah, you know it. You'll see it tonight.
I've never seen the band in any incarnation.
Oh, wow.
Ever before. So I'm really excited, and I'm even more excited that it's at the Whiskey A Go-Go, because obviously it's one of the most legendary places ever.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a show there. So I'm stoked, dude.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks.
And let's go. And
next time we'll do it on your home turf.
I like that. Well, you coming back anytime soon? You coming back anytime soon? I know you've just been there pretty recently.
But we're trying to work on some dates for 2019 for sure.
Cool. Yeah. And a new record for the new year,
perhaps? Yeah, we've already started writing material for it.
Right on.
Yeah.
Nice one, Adam. Thank you very much, mate. Cheers.
Thank you.